Previously on Video Killers.
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there. Yeah. All you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it. And there's a genie, a magic genie, but he can't wait to grant your wishes.
Hello, welcome to the Video Killers Podcast. I'm Tim Hawley, one half of Tape Freaks, and I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, starting with the other half of Tape Freaks, Colette Ritchie.
Hello.
And Greg Kay, our wonderful editor and engineer, and our punching bag of audio mistakes.
Hi.
What does everybody watch this week?
I watched Random Acts of Violence.
Tonight we have a one-hour special treat lined up for you as I'm joined by none other than Todd Walkley, brainchild behind one of the most successful R-rated comic books ever, Slasher Man.
Slasher Man's like my life. I find it inspiring.
This is a road trip that will be really fun and really informative.
We are staying in all motels. They're all rural and they're all rich.
Guys, we are in the middle of nowhere. We need to figure it out.
Oh my god, what the fuck is going on?
How was that?
All right. It's a slasher film directed by Jay Baruchel on Shudder. The gore effects are really good. A lot of practical effects. It kind of reminded me of the effects done in the TV show Hannibal.
Okay.
In a couple of ways, because They're kind of creative, how the killer did kind of creative stuff with the bodies and whatnot as well. I think I would have loved this movie more when I was younger and didn't care so much about plot holes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
This one really, it was one of those where I kept going, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll let that slide, I guess. The acting was fine. Jay Baruchel is a comedian first. He's kind of known for doing all the Seth Rogen movies. He's a Seth Rogen buddy. And He did make one really fun movie that he was in that I really liked called Goon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, with the Sean hockey one. William Scott. Is that his name?
Yeah, the first the Goon's great. One. I really like that one.
I haven't seen the second one, but apparently he directed the second one. He kind of directs horror sort of like comedy. It's got all the same beats.
Yeah.
I think those are actually close to begin with.
Yeah, for sure. We've seen a lot of like comedy. Like, you know, there's obviously Jordan Peele is one of the most recent and amazing examples of someone whose foundations in comedy and obviously translates that incredibly well to horror. But like, yeah, I feel like that comedy and horror are definitely deeply related in the setup and punch, you know, kind of punchline in a sense. Like it's like you have your setup and your gag in a, like in a horror film or release.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, right. Yeah, they're both also places where you could easily fail because like if your audience isn't on board, you're lost.
Yeah. I think both are harder than they seem to
for sure.
Make work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'll have its fans.
This is a Shudder original, like they produced it. Or they just acquire it?
No, it's a Shudder exclusive. I think they just acquired it.
Okay. I wasn't familiar with it until I think you mentioned it, that you'd watched it. And I wasn't, that wasn't on my radar at all for some reason. We watched Vivarium, the new film on Amazon with Imogen Poots? Is that how you say her name? I'm not sure. But and Jesse Eisenberg. It's kind of a sci-fi, it's like totally like a quarantine nightmare movie.
Yeah,
like not the ideal movie to watch during a quarantine, but it was good.
It was good. It was creepy, and then we went on a walk the next day, and I was like, I don't like this.
Yeah. The setup is there like a kind of young couple that are house shopping, I guess, and they walk into this place that's got a bunch of kind of like I don't know what you call those, like they're not track housing, but it's like a housing community where all the houses look exactly the same, like mm-hmm. townhouses basically.
Sure.
And the salesman is like a super weirdo creep, but like they like agree to go tour a house just to kind of, I don't know,
just because
he just wasn't backing down, and they follow him there, and then he disappears or like kind of just takes off, and then they try to leave, and then they're just stuck in this community. They can't find their way out, and they eventually like run out of gas, and then them trying to live in this like house, and then weird shit just keeps happening and happening and happening, and it's escalating more and more and kind of going crazy.
It's kind of like a Twilight Zone episode or Outer Limits. It's like an Outer Limits.
I think it was one of the last trailers I saw at Alamo.
Yeah, we were supposed to screen it at one of the Fantastic Fest films we were going to do a limited run of, and then we were going to do a special screening where there was going to be a live stream with Jesse Eisenberg and Emotion Poots and the director and stuff. So I'm kind of bummed that didn't happen, because I was curious to hear what they have to say about it. I haven't looked up a whole lot, but I think it's like it's another one of those films like we've been seeing a lot of, like a Extraordinary and some of these other ones, where it's like partially like an Irish film council, partially another country. Like it's like a few different countries' film councils like funded it, but it's one of those movies where you like watch and there's literally like probably 15 production companies at the beginning. Like it goes on and on and on. It's like clearly like all these little small companies pitched in probably, you know, a couple thousand dollars or whatever to get to the budget that they needed or whatever it was. But it's clearly like, yeah, like it's one of those ones where they like, you know, the lottery funded in whatever country it was. I think it was mainly Irish production, but I'm not positive on that.
Well, I definitely am curious. So would you give it a...
Yeah, it's worth checking out.
I really liked the... there's been a couple like smaller horror movies that I've seen lately that where they play the like suburban housewife or like mom kind of like character. Like they actually like explore it in a way where it's interesting rather than like tired and misogynist and like boring, but like that they did that really well with this in this one. I liked Imogen's character a lot all the way through, and Jesse Eisenberg. I mean, they both did a really good job.
Literally the film relies on those two and one other
actor.
Kid actor, so it's like, yeah,
who's also really good in it.
Yeah Everybody does an amazing job. I would say it's like, it wasn't like my favorite movie we've watched this year, you know, like those kind of indie ones, but it's definitely interesting and it's really well done. It's worth checking out. I think Amazon got the exclusive on that one, I'm pretty sure, but it's streaming on Amazon Prime. If you have Prime, it's free.
Awesome.
Or you can steal it and not support Amazon.
Well, no, come on now. I guess you also watched at least the first episode, but we watched the first episode of Lovecraft Country, which we should definitely touch on.
1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
It's back. Getting reacquainted with old friends.
Uncle George, the reason I'm back home, my father, he's gone missing.
1, 2, 3.
He wrote me. The place he wants me to go is in Lovecraft Country.
1, 2, 3.
This place.
1, 2, 3.
It's dangerous.
That was really good.
We really, really enjoyed that first episode. I'm excited to see more. You said you watched the first one, right? Or you watched the first two at this point?
Yeah, I watched the first two. I'll talk about part one with you, since part two is still going great.
Yeah.
I like yourself. I really liked the first episode. It felt a little HBO-y in times, you know, like how HBO has to have some gratuitous sexual situation for no reason. I'm reading the book currently, and of course that's not in the book, you know.
Right,
I haven't got to that part if it is.
Is it take place like in the kind of Jim Crow South? Like, does it have that going for it?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I love the opening scene, which is not in the book, where it goes from that kind of cliched war scene to suddenly it opens like up and it's
Cthulhu and Jackie Robinson.
Yeah.
It's like, God, it's so great. Yeah.
That voiceover was from the Jackie Robinson biography.
Okay.
They have like a little voiceover going there, and then I was like, what is this? And all of a sudden Jackie Robinson shows up and smashes Cthulhu with a bat.
Smashes him down the middle.
I am sold. This is crazy and awesome. The cast is really, really solid so far. Like, I really like everybody in mm-hmm. it. Do you know how long this season is?
It might be 10.
Yeah, I'm excited to see where it goes. It definitely mm-hmm. was, yeah, the first episode sold me on following through for sure.
I was definitely disappointed it was not a thing I could just watch all at one time.
I know you hate that. Because hate of that. Netflix, it's like, yeah, what?
I guess we also watched The Vast of Night, I believe was acquired by Amazon. It was another festival one that was getting some buzz. I don't know the director's name, but the director writer, it's their first film. First and only credit they have on IMDb, and it's very impressive. The budget is under $1 million. It's not a huge budget by any means, but they definitely put every penny on screen, it seems like to me. The general premise of the movie is
which you didn't tell me on purpose because yeah. you're mean.
Well, I asked if you wanted to watch anything and you said sure, and then I said, do you have an opinion? And you said no, and I was like, all right, I'm putting an alien movie on.
There's opinions that I have that are just like always there though.
Yeah, well, you should point out that Colette has, well, you explain it, Colette.
Oh, I don't like alien movies. Aliens are horrible and scary, and they're probably real. And this movie is...
Well, specifically alien abduction movies or aliens coming to Earth. Like alien and aliens in space and stuff.
Oh, yeah. If they're where they belong, in space.
I'll take this moment to announce next week we're talking Fire in the Sky.
And no, especially not that one. Fire in the Sky. Nope. I have seen that movie. That is not okay.
Yeah. But yeah, this one is not... It's not... This one, I would say, is not scary
until I got to the part where it was like exactly like my recurring nightmare.
Colette was terrified. But it is it takes place in the 50s in New Mexico, and it's basically around the film centralizes around these two main characters, two younger kids. One of them is a kind of, or I don't know, probably teenage early 20s guy who's works at the and they both live in a small town. He works like overnight at a radio station. And then there's a younger girl who is the overnight switchboard operator. And there's a basketball game that's happening at the high school that everybody in the town is at that night. And like some weird broadcasts are coming through over the phones that she patches to him over the radio to see if he can understand it. Cause he's like this town's like AV geek. Mm-hmm. He understands all the, you know, recording things and radios and stuff. And he doesn't know what it is. So then they start broadcasting the sound to see if they can get some information. And then they start, it's sort of in the same, if anybody's seen Pontypool, which is another film I highly recommend.
But don't look anything up about Pontypool.
Just watch it. Pontypool, great. But it's similar in that where like part of the story is told through phone calls coming in and people, you know, describing things and people citing things and like, you know, you're finding out what's happening and but it's really hyper stylized in the way they shot it. And it's some of it I don't really think quite works. I guess I really don't quite understand it. It just feels like a little bit over, they overdo it. They zoom into like a TV set over and over again for some reason.
I started thinking about that just now and I was like, I wonder if at some point they were trying to just do it all in one shot or if I wasn't paying enough attention and those were the only cuts.
There are really, really long cuts or long takes. That
like long takes that go all around the town. Mm-hmm. Like it's kind of following the two characters who are talking the whole time. Like
that's ambitious.
Yeah. It's really ambitious. Mm-hmm. Like it's so, yeah, I mean, it's an impressive film. I really, really liked it. It was the two leads do an incredible job. I mean, everybody in it does an incredible job, but they are really, really, especially good in it. And it's a really neat little story and it's told very, really, very well. And I have to also say that the score is really good. Like mm-hmm. the music in it is so good. And I can't wait. I've been Googling and I haven't found if anybody's officially releasing it, but if it gets released, I'm definitely going to pick it up because it's one of those scores where it's like, I was like, man, whoever did this did a really, really, really good job. But yeah, if anybody, again, that's another Amazon Prime one. And if people have Amazon Prime, seek it out. It's called The Vast of Night. Highly recommended.
Yeah, I'll definitely check that out. That sounds right up my alley.
Yeah.
Do we have to talk about the sisterhood?
Out of a wasteland, ruled by fear and death, appears a young sorceress with undiscovered strength.
Girl, no woman can travel the world without a man to defend her.
Her only family brutally murdered by a ruthless warlord.
Help! Help!
Now, in her thirst for justice, she joins forces with a renegade army of Amazons.
Men have nothing to say about what we do.
Let's take them.
For control of the wasteland, the Sisterhood.
We don't. I just put it in there. I put that in. This is, has nothing to do with
no,
that.
No, we should talk about the Sisterhood a little bit. What's at least we did watch it.
That's the post-apocalyptic lady tribe movie.
Oh, we're so excited about it.
Super. They all have superpowers. You know,
the poster monkey. Was really.
They all have quote good. Unquote
it was really deceiving. That poster.
Poster was very. That was a big old lie. But there were horses in it.
There were horses.
There were horses. Yep.
There were women in it.
They wore a little bit more clothing than the poster.
That was nice because there was not much clothing on the
but
front.
One lady like shoots lasers out of her eyes to move some rocks. And,
once.
Yeah. Well, once. Yeah. But at least it happened. One can heal people, I guess.
Sometimes. And one talked to a hawk. Was that the other one?
Yeah.
Yeah. But seriously, yeah. If that poster was the movie.
Yeah.
What a kick-ass.
That would have been fun. Yeah. But like all post-apocalyptic movies from that time period that you've never heard of, it was boring a little bit.
What? They didn't find a bunker and find a bunch of machine guns?
It didn't make any sense. That was kind of nice that they did weird stuff where you could be like, what? Oh, now you all have guns, but you didn't know guns were a thing before? Didn't you just say this is 2021? Like,
yeah.
And it's the world year. Ended in the 80s?
Yeah, it's next year.
What? It was so fake. They didn't even bring up the pandemic. You know, like...
I was going to say, they're all wearing leather and driving around like, you know, Mad Max cars in the desert. And
yeah, wearing the most impractical clothing.
But I have to say that 2021 could easily look that like that. I would not doubt it.
I don't know why they were all... Clearly, there were horses around. Like, everybody's trying to get gas for some reason. Like,
nothing made sense. I mean, is there a plot? What's the plot? It's, I don't even remember the plot.
I'm gonna be honest,
I tuned out about halfway through the movie.
Yeah, it was guy was cutting things out and making collages. I was like, I don't know.
There's rival gangs, and the one gang kidnaps one of the Sisterhood because he's mad that they made him look bad in that one fight where they beat him up, and then. They're trying to sell her to get something, and then the Sisterhood are chasing after them to get her back.
I mean,
and then there's definitely like they get to like a castle thing at the end where they have like they've been kidnapping all the different Sisterhood ladies that they're keeping hostage.
Yeah, and then they all stand around in a circle and disappear.
Yeah,
that's the freaking end.
Yeah,
yeah, I remember the end.
It's like if you could stand in a circle and disappear. None of them were moved from the room that they were in. But I'm like, if you could all just stand in a damn circle and disappear, why didn't you just do that when you were in this room before?
It could have been cool. It had a cool message: women power, you know, empowerment. Yeah. And you know, that's.
I mean, there was a lot more ladies in it than I was expecting there to be, and they were doing a whole lot more than I thought they were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they were more clothed than usual.
They were way more clothed.
Well, I guess we can leave it at that. We all recommend the Sisterhood is what you're saying.
Dude, yeah.
If you've never seen a post-apocalyptic movie from the 80s, this is one you could check out.
Probably not the first one to check out.
Yeah. You might like it.
Yeah, you don't know. You don't have a bar for it.
If you've never seen one, watch The New Barbarians.
It was a time of chaos and violence until one day there appeared... The New Barbarians.
All right. Anybody else have anything else that they've watched, read, or done recently that they want to plug? Or should we move on to our main theme for this episode?
We can move on to the main theme, I guess.
All right. Let's do it.
All right. Killer Cops. A very, very topical film conversation, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it kind of all came out of the fact that we watched over Zoom with a bunch of people the Maniac Cop trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also other killer cop movies that exist in the world, so that'd be fun to talk about. Greg, you watched Maniac Cop 1 with us, right? But then you watched 2 and 3 on your own?
That's correct. Yeah, okay. I watched the first one with you a couple months ago?
No, It was about a month ago. But
it was like 100 years ago, or perhaps
it feels
two
like
weeks
100
ago.
Years ago, because I've seen part two, and after part two, I don't remember anything before part two.
Yeah.
Well, I guess if we get into it. Yeah, the first one, I mean, they're all three of them are quote unquote directed by Bill Lustig. The third one is up for debate, but all three of them are also quote unquote written by Larry Cohen, who we all love. Mm-hmm. The third one is unlikely that he wrote much of it. The first film stars Bruce Campbell, Tom Atkins, if people would know from Halloween 3, The Fog, Lethal Weapon, Creepshow, among other things. Tom Atkins, I love whenever he shows up in films. Oh, you're Night of the Creeps.
I met him at Crypticon a few years back, mm-hmm. and I had him sign for my, I had him sign something. He was really nice, but I talked to him for a while. I left, and then about 20 minutes later, I thought of something, and because I had a VIP pass, because mm-hmm. I'm important. I could just walk up to him. So I walked up to him again, and he goes, "Hey, Greg," which is really cool. He remembered my name.
Yeah.
20 minutes before.
Yeah, that was probably when he was at that was the year he was at Crypticon. We hosted a screening of Halloween 3 and had him out for a Q&A at the Mall of America. He was so awesome. He was so funny, and he sat and watched part of the movie with us, like with the crowd, and like was just like cackling, like laughing at it and stuff like that. And oh man, he was just like the like most genuine, nicest, like it's like exactly what you would want when you meet somebody like that to be. And mm-hmm. he's
answering questions like he was just a guy we knew and was like, "Oh yeah, like, I'll tell you all about that." And we're like,
super candid,
no pretension at all.
Yeah.
No. I just loved it.
Talking about how like I think when they wrapped Halloween 3, they had like a kind of post shoot party and they all got really wasted in the hotel, and then he's like ended up having to crawl down the hallway to get to his hotel room and then got on the plane the next morning and like it was like super hungover, and like some I can't remember what it was, like one of his like somebody he knew personally like was on the flight and he felt really embarrassed because he was so hungover. It's like just like all kinds of just rant. It's like, wow man, you just like it doesn't matter, like he just like laughing at everything and like mm-hmm. oh, he just seemed like so awesome. But
I love how Todd Farmer and his director that did the My Bloody Valentine 3D, mm-hmm. that they keep putting him in stuff.
Yeah, mm-hmm. because, like, they I think they
probably because they're like, this guy is really
this
fun
guy's
to
awesome.
Work with.
That's exactly what it is.
Movies right now, and I could get Tom Atkins, I'd call that a big get. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, he's still out there working, and you know, he's doing a lot of like plays and stuff in Pittsburgh.
Is he still alive?
Yeah.
I thought he died in the terrible year where everybody died.
No, I don't think so. Not that
no,
I'm aware.
He's still alive.
Yeah. But there's a short little interview with him on the Maniac Cop 1 disc, and he was another, like, Robert Davi. Yeah. Like Robert Davi was promised a lead, but more than what he got in the other films. Tom Atkins thought he was the lead in Maniac Cop 1, I guess, and even though he gets thrown out of a window, like, in the first act. so he's just kind of like laughing about it, and he's like, "Yeah, that movie didn't do that well." He's like, "Wait, did it? I don't know. I guess I don't remember. I can't remember what happened with that one, but it was fun. You know, I got to meet a bunch of people on it." And it's like, just...
I hate to admit it, but I forgot he was freaking in Maniac Cop when we were talking about it the other day.
Yeah,
and I looked, I was like, "But that's right."
Yeah, mm-hmm. and he's like a pretty like.
But it's because he dies right away.
He's a pretty cool character in the beginning. Yeah, like
yeah,
but then they just like it's sort of like a Psycho thing where like you think he's the lead and they like kind of like they kill him real quick and then it moves on to the Bruce Campbell character. But yeah, we got Robert Zadar as Maniac Cop in all three films. The first film he's got a lot less makeup on. It's like very simplified, like kind of just like a little bits here and there.
And stuff.
He kind of looks, I think it looks really good in the first film, but then they really go all in on this in the second film. And it sounds like because Larry Cohen was just like, "Oh no, we want it to be like more crazy and more insane." Like, he's like, "The first film looks terrible." But it's like, I think the first film, he looks fine. Like he looks good, but there's some really fun stunts and stuff in the first film I guess the first one's just more straightforward. Like it's a much more simple kind of mystery. You don't really know much about what's going on. It's
somebody's being framed, so you're like, who really did it?
But you know that he's doing it because you see his silhouette in the park in the beginning when he kills that woman when she runs up to him to get help.
Yeah, Oh yeah, but they also like obscure his face for a while.
Yeah, but the original film was basically greenlit on a pitch that Larry Cohen had done to Bill Lustig over a lunch, where he was trying to convince him to do a sequel to Maniac, Bill Lustig's other film, and gave him the tagline, which is, what is the tagline? Is it like you
have the right to remain silent forever.
You have the right to remain silent forever.
Forever, yeah. Which they then use again on the poster for part two.
The first one feels like a Larry Cohen movie in the plot, even though he like slapped it together pretty quick. Where it's like there's good cops, there's bad cops, there's corrupt politicians, there's, you know, everybody's kind of all over. There's no hard line of like morality anywhere.
The main guy is having an affair on his wife at the beginning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In the opening scene of him, like,
and then she dies as sort of a result of that.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's no good people in that movie.
Well, there's with some. I feel like there was a couple people where I was like Tom Atkins. He was okay, not a bad guy.
Cool.
No, Tom Atkins is really good. But then Tom Atkins, like right away when he shows up in the morgue, he's like, I think a cop did this. Like he like instantly yeah, is like
they're like, using a cop did this? He's like, yeah, and here's why.
Yeah. And he kind of like lays out like what he thinks happened, and it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, here's his badge. It's sitting right on the victim.
Was it? No.
No, I'm just kidding. No.
Did you have any other details for part one?
That scene with the parade, they shot that even before the script as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Guerrilla style. I think they say something on the extras.
Yeah, they shot it to show to financiers to like prove that they basically told them that they had a like almost finished film, I think, with that, even though they just shot that one scene or something like it's something along those lines. But yeah, they just ran into the parade and shot without a permit, and it was like a real parade. But that was a Larry Cohen. He did that a couple times. Mm-hmm. Like he did that in God Told Me
for the same parade.
Yeah,
like, not the exact same parade, but like annually, he'd be like there filming something.
Right, which is crazy.
It was the St. Patrick's one, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then it's immediately Christmas later on in the movie.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know,
those two holidays are close together, right?
And God Told Me To, they used the same parade where he shot without a permit, but they had Andy Kaufman in the parade with a gun running around,
mm-hmm.
which is just like, I can't believe.
I can believe Andy Kaufman did that.
Oh, yeah.
However, I can't believe somebody else, a group of people were like, yeah, this is a good idea.
Well, yeah. And then they did it again in Maniac Cop.
The cops eventually got wise to it, and they tried to claim it was just a student film. And they're like, got a freaking crane or that student film.
Yeah. Oh god, it's so funny though.
Bruce Campbell hates the movie.
Yeah.
And he says the worst thing he's ever done.
That is not the worst thing. Yeah.
No. Yeah, Tom Atkins is basically it's not the worst thing I guess I've ever worked on, but it's not one of my highlights. He's like, his favorite film still to this day is Night of the Creeps. So he doesn't like talking bad about it, but he's also like, I don't really remember it very well, you know. It's like,
yeah. I love that Night of the Creeps is his favorite.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's so good in it.
I got good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
I'm surprised Michael Moriarty didn't show up.
Yeah, you'd think he'd at least have a cameo in one of the movies.
Yeah. Sam Raimi pops up in a quick cameo. Mm-hmm. And Jake LaMotta. Famous boxer that Raging Bull was based on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the story is that he was just friends with Cohen.
Yeah.
And he said something like, well, why don't you ever put me in your films? He was like, all right, there you go.
Yeah,
that's totally like a Larry Cohen thing though. It's like everybody that he's like friends with, or like every actor like he's worked with, is like, yeah, you can have a little cameo role in this one too. Like what's the guy he's like he's another one of the cops in Q, and yeah, but anyway, he's one of the cops in Maniac Cop 1 too, which is really funny.
Campbell and Robert Zadar in the same film. I mean,
it's a lot of chin.
Yeah. So the battle of the chins.
The battle of the chins. You just can't not mention that because they're both known for their chins.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Zadar got the role because he was in a movie called The Night Stalker,
mm-hmm.
May 86.
I got to track that one down. I'm not real familiar with that film.
First I heard of it.
Yeah.
When doing the research, I like that, especially in the first one, like you mentioned earlier, they keep him in the shadows.
Yeah.
He's always spinning the stick really well, too. I like how he does that. And then does he have the sword in it?
I don't think that comes in until the second film. I think it's mostly, I mean, he chokes the one lady, right, in the park. Like, he's just more physically like a brute in the first film, I think, than he's like fully like stabbing people and stuff. Because I think it's like the sword is first revealed in the beginning of two, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about two then, because I think that's all I have on one.
You have the right to remain silent.
He's still alive.
Forever. Again.
You can't kill the dead.
Why has this been kept from the public and the press?
When this leaks out, people are not going to want to pick up the phone and dial 911. We're looking at a bloodbath here.
Maniac, come to. You'll be screaming blue murder.
Two is great. I mean, I think for me, I think two is the highlight of the trilogy. Like, they really, like, they clearly had a bigger budget and they upped the ante big time in part two, even though the plot is basically just more of the same in a sense, you know. It's like they just, like, it's a direct continuation of the first film. And then, but they just, like, right away kind of write off the two main characters. Like, Bruce Campbell is out of the movie within the first 10 minutes or less.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. He gets killed with Robert, or I'm sorry, James Earl Jones' father.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's a newsstand.
The newsstand.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so
he dies quickly. I thought, like, you're right, the plot's similar, but it's like they cut off all the pesky stuff, like character development and whatnot. There's like, we don't need that. Let's not have a ton of characters. Let's just focus on Davi and then the therapist, or not therapist. What is her role?
She's a cop therapist.
Is she?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's not the title, but like, yeah.
Yeah, she's a therapist for the police department, Claudia Christian. And she's always running out doing stuff with him.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, they would not do that.
It's just, you wouldn't do that. Yeah.
No. You don't get both jobs.
I like how she shows up in costume, in the uniform, because she doesn't shoot guns, and she's like wearing it. And they're like, it's like, what? I'm sorry. We go back.
No. But yeah, she's the new female lead is, what's her, the actress's name?
It's Claudia Christian.
Okay. And she was on, like, I mean, we know her for sure from The Hidden, which we've screened for Tape Freaks. Mm-hmm. She's like got a major role. And that was also the movie that got her the role in Maniac Cop. It sounds like that they really liked her in that, and which led to her being cast, is what they were kind of saying in the behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, she's really good. And I mean, she does a really good job in Maniac Cop too. Mm-hmm. But hearing the behind the scenes stuff, she was definitely very poorly treated by everybody, or specifically by the crew. She did agree to be on the special features and was interviewed for it, and definitely didn't, like, she wasn't like directly talking shit about people.
No,
but was definitely
casting some shade. But she was like these guys are jerks.
I heard her and Davi didn't get along at all.
No,
I think they both said that. I think
they both, both of them basically said that, it was a clash of personalities, and they just were never able to, they never clicked. And they both aren't like disparaging of each other, but they just were just like, yeah, it just was a fact. Like, we just didn't see eye to eye at all. And like,
the stuff they put that woman through.
Oh my God.
Mm-mm.
There's a scene in this movie where she is in a runaway car handcuffed to the steering wheel,
but she's on the outside of
the car. That was,
it's amazing scene, to be honest.
An incredible scene.
But
like,
she's like, when they're shooting it, the stunt guy is like, well, we have to have her in it because it's a wide open shot. Like, it's always, you just can always see it's her.
Right.
So they didn't really have much stunt doubling happening.
No, it's like actress
just hanging on the outside of a car where they're doing car stunts.
Yeah.
Like,
and at one point it hit something, like the car hit a bump or whatever, and she was like on a platform and the platform broke, I guess. And so she like almost got killed, like doing that scene, which is insane.
She's like, she's happy with the movie itself.
Yeah. She's definitely proud of the work that she did, but.
And she's like, it looks great on screen, but like, she's like, what more can you say about a stunt where you almost died?
Yeah.
As far as doing the stunts, I don't think it was a question of anybody talking me into it. It just made it made sense for the camera to be on me, and in order to get the shot and make it look realistic that I was handcuffed, we had to build a platform and do it that way.
I mean, we really had her doing the jumps when the car got hit. There's one stunt that I think put a dummy in, and that was when it went on two wheels. But when it got hit from behind, we really had a girl there, and now that I think about it, I even cringe.
I was just handcuffed to a car, and the platform broke, and we were going 35 miles an hour, you know, so I was dragged a little bit. It was not a very enjoyable experience, I have to say. You know, what do you say when you could have been killed?
She's great in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, she really does have a good presence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But just the fire stunts at the end, there were nothing like I've ever seen before. And yeah. This is all pre-CGI. This is real fire.
Yeah, there's a finale where the maniac cop is just like laying waste to this police precinct, right? Or jail cell?
It's a prison.
Yeah.
And he gets lit on fire, and that sequence goes on for a long time where he's just walking around the building engulfed in flames, still just like attacking people. And it's just like that stunt. I mean, like, you know that they had to put him out and then light him up and put him out like over and over again to get each cut. But it's like, I can't even imagine the amount of firework that they had to do for that one movie. And then it culminates where, like, it wasn't originally in the script, but then they changed it because they needed a better finale, I guess, based on when they were getting going. And so there's a scene where the maniac cop and the lead character like go out the through a wall, like a brick wall, like,
yeah,
what, five stories up, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, and the fire stunt, when the stunt guy's talking about it, is that like when you're engulfed in flames like that, you can't really breathe, because if you breathe in, you're gonna burn your lungs. So like diving out that window while engulfed in flames and then falling, you can't breathe in. You can breathe out, but then once you hit, they have to extinguish you before you can breathe again. And like, he's like, yeah, if we would have,
well, and then they drop, but where they end up was like above where the fire extinguishers could reach.
Yeah.
So when they hit, they had to have a full breath of air so that when you get the wind knocked out of you, you aren't instinctually trying to inhale, because you might still have air left over in your lungs. But yeah, then you have to be lowered to the point where they can hit you with the extinguishers.
Yeah.
God, just thinking about that gives me anxiety.
Oh my God. Yeah. And then the stunt guys is like, yeah, if we were to do it again, I would not do that.
It's like, I would do it different.
Yeah. Yep. We would definitely not do it that way.
Pretty much everything he said, he was like, nope, I would do it different. Like, because he was a new stunt coordinator. Like, he'd never been the lead stunt coordinator, and he was ambitious, apparently. Yeah,
I think his name is Ciro Rosados, I think is his name. But he was also the stunt coordinator on part three. And my, that guy, like, I got to look up his IMDb, because I got to see if there's other movies that he did stunt work on. Because if he did, I want to see everything that guy has done, because the stunt work he did alone on these movies is just like mind blowing, like the car stunts and stuff.
Yeah. Two is the one where the maniac cop is like driving next to the van.
No, that's nope, in
that's part that's three.
Three.
It doesn't help that they have the same actors in like this one and that one. Yeah. And like,
well, part two really blew me away. As far as I can't believe this is not talked about more. It's just for the stunts alone.
Yeah.
And this is all before, I mean, I'm sure they use some cables and there's probably, you know, some slick editing here and there, but there's a scene early in the movie where Robert Davi shoots a perp that jumps out a window, goes like 5-6 feet, lands on top of a van, and then flips onto the ground and just lands like a sack of potatoes on the ground. And then he gets shot. You know? Yeah. and then they do the squib and everything. And I looked at that. I was like, that's a real street. I can't figure out how they did that without this man getting hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's supposedly, I mean, there's a lot of crazy car stunts where they're crashing cars. And like, I mean, there's a lot of just insanity going on, but supposedly they filmed a lot of it. Like, they filmed a bunch of it in New York, where the first movie was filmed mostly in LA. And so was the third movie, but the second one was filmed mostly in New York. And then all the action sequences, they actually shot in New Jersey with a bunch of off-duty New York police officers or Jersey police officers,
mm-hmm.
Because it was around Christmas time and they were all trying to make extra money for Christmas. So they were getting this off-duty pay. And because they were like, all of them were willing to do whatever just to get this off-duty pay for Christmas, they were letting, they're just blocking off streets and just letting them do whatever they want. Like, so like they got a lot away with a lot of stuff that there's no way that they would have been able to get away with without that, which is crazy.
We'll never see a movie like this again. No. Not, at least not made in the United States.
No, not at all. And there's some fun, there's some other fun cameos. Like you said, Danny Trejo's in the...
Danny Trejo's in the jail cell for like 2 seconds and you're like, oh! And then they never go back.
Yeah. no speaking part. Which again, I wonder if that's like the connection to The Hidden, because he's also in like a jail cell in The Hidden, like in the background of one scene.
Well, yeah, that's his first, like the first 5 years of his career was just the other guy in the prison role, wasn't it?
Yeah. He gets to talk in there sometimes though.
Yeah.
Not this one. But then we had Clarence Williams III.
Yeah, from Tales from the Hood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is great. He was in it a lot longer than I thought he was going to be, and I loved him.
Yeah. But in the interview, too, they're describing this movie. They were saying that the first movie was a little bit more of like a straightforward kind of slasher mystery kind of film, and this one was they're going to go full kind of comic booky. With the action and the gore and the blood and things like that, they were going to go a little bit more larger than life. But then the whole idea was that this is like clearly he's like a Frankenstein story. Like he's just like the Frankenstein's monster kind of lumbering around and kind of wreaking havoc, which is funny.
He's almost a good guy in this one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he's killing people for revenge. It's more so in three, but they do, you know. Well, like after that, he seems to be killing people for a reason, or at least not just for a reason, but it seems like he's got a mission more.
In the opening of two, though, there's like the convenience store thing where he like shoots the guy behind the counter and then gives the gun to the perp and then like frames him for the murder. So he gets gunned down.
He gets gunned down by the cops in the next scene.
Yeah, the cops show up and they just, funny. He's like, I didn't do it. They're like, like cops do, right?
There's also,
who is he mainly killing in the second one?
Well, at first it looked like he was kind of working evil, like that. Killed the guy who was all happy that he won the lottery ticket. Remember the clerk won the lottery ticket for $5,000 because the perp was making him scratch off
all of them.
Because he was waiting for the boss to show up to open up the safe or whatever. And that guy who played the perp, I've seen him in other things. I just didn't.
Yeah, he looked familiar, but I didn't look him up.
He looks like one of those actors that always plays hoods.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But then he got killed. I'm trying to remember what the second kill was. Was it Bruce Campbell? So maybe...
Yeah, I think so. Because then he goes, Bruce Campbell gets killed. Right, like.
Yeah. Then he starts killing cops.
Then he starts killing cops.
Yeah.
And then I was a little disappointed that the blonde Teresa, I think her name was, the blonde lover of Bruce Campbell's
first film.
She shows up with a chainsaw, and I thought, all right, they didn't really go as far as I thought. Not to ruin it, but that was a pretty good scene too, though, where he's chasing them, and Claudia Christensen's character is just along for the ride, and she thinks that Teresa's just kind of having
a breakdown,
PTSD or whatever. Yeah,
PTSD.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny that in the first film, everybody's sort of in denial of what's happening, and then by the end, everybody's like, oh, it is Matt Cordell, like he's back from the dead and he's like wreaking havoc.
He was never dead in the first.
Well, yeah. He's like seeking revenge, right? But then in the second movie, it literally starts right where the first movie ends. Like it literally opens with the ending of part one as the opening of part two. But then everybody's like, doesn't remember that he's alive, it seems like.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got a 3 o'clock appointment. Oh, officers Mallory and Forrest. We're a little early, I guess.
That's right. Why don't we go get a cup of coffee? Are you going to find us unfit to go back on the job?
Well, I hope not. What do you think?
Well, I think we're both just as sane as you are.
Well, then you both realize that this Matt Cordell was killed in prison.
Yeah, right. But you see, we both just saw him on the pier. So what? Does that make us nuts?
What you saw was a very large man with a horribly disfigured face. And did he say he was Cordell?
No, he never spoke.
Well, then it could have been anyone in policeman's uniform, right?
There's also a deleted scene from part two on the disc that is a reprise of Sam Raimi's news reporter character. So there was supposed to be another cameo of Sam Raimi in two.
But Ted Raimi shows up in this
one. Well, No,
are you
going to
tell
three.
Me he's in three again?
Yeah, he's in three. Yeah, Ted Raimi shows up in three as that basically as a news reporter. Yeah.
Well, it's all blurred together. This one still had some good stuff, though. It had, actor-wise, cameo-wise, it had Charles Napier,
mm-hmm.
Michael Lerner, who was in everything in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought Duff, he was great. I mean, he smoked the hell out of those Marlboros.
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, he did.
As I used to be a smoker, I know what Marlboros look like. It was funny that it's more prominent, I think, in part three, but he was always smoking cigarettes with white filters. I'm like, that's not Marlboro Red.
No.
It's like, you're that's not fooling parliament. Me.
You're a phony.
You got a recessed filter in there. Yeah.
I thought Leo Rossi, who played Turkel, the serial killer,
mm-hmm.
was good because he was scary. That scene with the stripper when he goes back to her apartment.
Oh, yeah, that's mm-hmm. scary.
That was a terrifying scene in a lot of levels. It was scary mm-hmm. because they worked it well, but it was also creepy and disgusting.
Yeah, it mm-hmm. sounds like he was really a handful behind the scenes too, and he was researching the role, I guess, by going to like peep shows in strip clubs and stuff in New York, like on like 42nd Street, and he got like thrown out because he would just like trying to think of how he could be the creepiest he could be. So he would go to these peep show booths and put like quarter in and then just stare at the stripper straight in the eyes the entire time and not break eye contact until the window went down. Then he'd put a quarter in and then like the window wouldn't reopen. The bouncers would come in and drag him out mm-hmm. and throw him out.
I mean, how creepy do you have to be to get kicked out of a 42nd grindhouse?
Yeah.
Pretty creepy.
Yeah. So I think he brought that and put it all on the screen because mm-hmm. he is a real creeps.
Yeah.
Very, very sleazy, sweaty, gross.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that kind of tied into that idea that it's a Frankenstein movie because he was kind of the surrogate, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, the voice for him.
It's almost like the blind guy in Frankenstein that right. He's like sort of staying with him in this weird like his like weird little whatever hobo like.
Yeah, he's got this little like cave like area, and I kept thinking how much that place probably stunk.
Oh yeah,
sure. Like, he's drinking Armoretto.
Armoretto.
I kept thinking of when we were watching it. I kept thinking of Mighty Boosh, Old Greg.
Yeah,
like it's like almost like
definitely
you know,
had
it's
an
like,
old Greg vibe.
Totally like got an old Greg like yeah. like in love with the maniac cop almost. This mm-hmm. is like yeah. so weird.
No, like. Rape scenes in this movie? Is that true?
There's an attempted rape by him when he goes to the stripper.
Well, I don't know if he's gonna rape her. I think he's gonna kill her. I thought rape initially, but I think he's just gonna kill her.
Okay.
That's his thing.
But
it felt really creepy.
But it was creepier than anything. I mean, like rape scenes are fucking terrible and they should not be in movies, but this guy was just like everything he did was creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And it just had nothing to like I was like, you don't need a stupid rape scene in your goddamn movie to make the guy creepy. You just need him to be an actual creep.
Yeah.
Well, he was. Yeah. He didn't rape her. He was just creepy as hell.
Yeah,
creepy as hell.
Creep.
Part three?
Yeah, let's move on to part three, I guess.
When the violent...
This filthy creep's gonna make us rich.
...can't be controlled. When the guilty... ...can't be caught. When the lawless... can't be stopped.
Drop the gun!
The only hope left.
I saw a symbol in the dirt.
You see the symbol of anti-justice.
Is a cop.
Mr. May.
Who's ready to raise a little hell.
I need your very special kind, darkness.
From the darkest powers of creation.
Want to know about resurrection?
Comes a force more powerful than life, more lasting than death.
Nurse!
He has returned.
Who's in there?
As judge, jury, and executioner.
Oh my God.
I know what I saw.
To enforce the law.
Where is he? You'll find him.
With a vengeance. But now, the only way to end the massacre is to destroy
two tortured souls.
The madness.
Finish it.
Badge of silence. The maniac cop is back.
So this one is pretty interesting because when we're watching it, the credits came up and instead of Bill Lustig's name on the credits, it says Alan Smithy. And if anybody who doesn't know what Alan Smithy is, it's a fake name that directors will put on a film when they want their name removed, or if there is no like clear director. Alan Smithy is a lot of times used. It's kind of usually a middle finger to the producers, and it's sort of an inside thing, just so that, well, I don't know if it has to do with the Directors Guild or whatever, but if you see Alan Smithy name on a film, you know that there was something horribly went wrong because nobody wants credit for it. I did watch a little bit behind the scenes on, so I could run down a few of the fun things I learned. But when we were watching it, the general theme, we were like, is this supposed to be like a Bride of Frankenstein like concept? Because it definitely has that kind of vibe, like the other cop gets, the lady cop gets killed and Maniac Cop is like obsessed with her and he's got like trying to like bring her back kind of thing. And that is absolutely what it was. They pitched the film, Larry Cohen pitched it as Bride of Frankenstein, but with Maniac Cop. And they were like, the new producers who were producing it, greenlit it based on that alone and without a script. And then they basically admitted that they had never seen part one or two, but kind of like, were like, hey, like, I think I understand what this is. Then they went and watched one and two and were like, oh, these are pretty good movies. So like, we know now what to expect. The quote from Bill Lustig was that everybody, it is a film where everybody got to piss in the pot. So that's what you got was a pot full of piss. He says, I hate this movie with all my heart and I can't stand it. And so basically they started trying to go into production and Larry Cohen supposedly wrote a script, or at least there was at least enough of a concept,
like an outline,
where they were going to start working on it. And his idea was that it was supposed to be a black lead in the third film and it was going to take place in Harlem. And they wanted a much more like black cast for it, where Maniac Cop was like laying waste in Harlem, I guess, is what the concept was. But the producers said that the Japanese distributors, which was the main market they were selling to because the first film was so huge in Japan, they were saying that the Japanese distributors wouldn't buy it if there was a black lead, I guess. So they were making him reconfigure.
Everybody's racist all around the world.
So they went to go rework it. They were pushing for Robert Davi to come back, even though Lustig wanted to do something different. And then were forced to take Robert Davi back, which he had no problem with. He just wanted to go a different route. But with that, it seems like Larry Cohen didn't really want to write the script anymore because all the things that he wanted to do were then chiseled away and everybody had their opinions at that point, because once they gave into that one thing, is sort of the floodgates were open and everybody was like, had what they wanted out of it.
As so, is what to happen.
So they were about to go into production, but they still didn't have a finalized script and they kept trying to get Larry Cohen on the phone. And supposedly they called him. Larry Cohen answered while he was driving. It's like early 90s. Like Larry Cohen had like a car phone and answered. And they were like, Larry, we need the script like ASAP. And he's like, oh, okay, cool. You got a pen? And they're like, what? Like, sure. And he's like, okay, fade in. And he started trying to dictate the script on the phone while he was driving.
Good God.
And they were like, yeah, no, you need to like send it to us. Like we can't, we're not doing this. And so then he just is like, kind of like wanted really nothing to do with it at that point. They were like, ever since like everybody was like already fighting before they even began production. But they, but then the producer basically went and wrote a script based on the outlines that they had that Larry Cohen had written. So Larry Cohen didn't really write the script. It sounds like one of the producers wrote it.
And you can tell too.
Yeah.
He really can.
They also said that they were contractually obligated to turn in a 90-minute film. But Lustig was like, at that point, was like so pissed that he was battling with the producers and was really just, he said he just was showing up to cash his paycheck and was just kind of going through the motions. He was more dedicated to the action sequences with no real care about what the story was, is whatever what the producers are saying. He said that there's a lot of like, everybody's sort of like has conflicting stories. It sounds like they're all on good terms now because they all agreed to again speak to this in this behind the scenes, and Bill Lustig put the movie out on his label, so it's something, I guess. But when it all came to the end, Bill Lustig put together his rough cut, which would be like every single bit of footage they shot minus the clapper shots, and the runtime was 51 minutes. And then they said at that point they realized like how far off the rails this had gotten, and they needed him to shoot more. And then the producer wrote additional scenes. Lustig was pissed about it. The first scene that they tried to shoot was the shooting range scene with where Robert Davi and the lead are kind of going back and forth, like taking turns shooting at the targets. And they're talking about her birthday, like going out for drinks or something for her birthday. Lustig was pissed. He's like, I can't do this. And then walked off and quit the project. And then the producer then stepped in and shot the additional footage.
Is this the one where she's the psychiatrist? The psychologist?
No, that's the second one.
Oh, yeah. Man.
No, she's another cop.
She's just another cop. Okay.
Yeah, they just drop her character 100%.
Okay.
Yeah. The lady in the coma in this one, the lady who's like, I think the one who's supposed to be the bride of Frankenstein, she was supposed to be originally the lead from the first movie that got killed in the beginning of two, but they were trying to bring her back, I guess.
She was probably like, I'm good. Thanks. Yeah.
The other fun bit I found out was that like we were talking about earlier, there's an amazing set piece at the end of the film. There's another fire stunt where the maniac cop is fully engulfed in flames, driving a cop car while they're in Robert Davi and the leader in the back of an ambulance. And they're fighting and crashing into each other. And he's, you know, reaching out, the door gets ripped off the cop car. He's fully engulfed in flames. Well, that was another, like this, the same stunt guy did all the stunts for it. And he was just like saying that it was really, really difficult because in some of the shots, there's a hidden driver in the passenger seat enclosed in a box to keep him protected from the fire. So he could drive the car while Robert Davi or the stunt person is in the driver's seat, engulfed in flames. But they would have to have like these safety systems in place because they're going so fast, the flames would be keep, you know, flaming. So they'd have to buttons that they could just like extinguish themselves, almost like a NASCAR kind of extinguishing system that they had installed. And then they'd have a backup car following them with extinguishers just as a backup safety. But they ran into like all kinds of problems with it because that scene goes on for a really long time.
It does, yeah.
And so there's like, you know, you're shooting multiple sequences and it just took forever to do. And they're like they could only really have them on fire for 20 seconds at a time, but they kind of pushed that a few times, it sounds like, and really was like pretty dangerous. But the craziest thing is that there's a few shots where if it's far enough away, they had a dummy in the car that they would light on fire. And then they would have the driver in there driving it with the dummy in there so they could drive it longer with the dummy going. But they were putting the dummy in the car and somehow the dummy's foot hit the accelerator.
Oh, fun.
After they ignited it and the car went off with nobody in it. And so the dummy engulfed in flames was driving a car down this like busy street in LA. And they had to get in their cars and chase after it in hopes that it wasn't going to kill somebody.
Oh, good God.
And I guess it went 5 blocks before it crashed into a propane tank. But luckily the propane tank didn't explode somehow.
Wow.
And they said that one of the other actresses was coming to the set and it was like basically coming straight at her. And for some reason, the first thought she had was that they were just screwing with her. She thought that it was like a joke somehow. And so she was like sort of like, didn't do anything, and then the last minute swerved out of the way and then realized there was nobody in the car.
wow
yeah
that's insane.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
But that scene is what makes the movie worthwhile.
Yeah it is definitely the standout scene for the third film.
You're right, it's a Bride of Frankenstein scenario, but they don't really go too far with it.
No. That we were saying it like it felt like they were going that way, and then it felt like then by the end we're like, oh, they just never delivered on that premise. And I was like kind of bummed because like, man, that would have been really cool if it was a Bride of Frankenstein. And then hearing them in the documentary be like, oh, that's what we were trying to do, and I was like, well, god damn it, like, why didn't you do it then? Because that would have been really cool.
And I love when Larry Cohen inserts commentary into these films because it's usually something that's very topical and heady in something that's just ridiculous. And that would have been an interesting thing to hear about, would have been him putting cops in Harlem, you said?
Yeah, that was his original plan.
That would have been interesting. But this movie, the tone was for the cops was all we can't do our jobs because the law is too much for us and woohoo us. And I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it was
very
much more pro cop movie than the first two.
It's not even pro cop. It's like, it's pro crime and punishment. Wow, that's really hard to say.
Yeah.
Pro crime and punishment. Wow.
You got a good enough. Yeah.
I'll see what I can do with that.
Yeah.
Jesus. I thought the movie was not, it was all right. It wasn't nearly as fun as part two. The stunt work at the end was great. Otherwise, the cameos were pretty fun.
Yeah.
Ted Raimi.
Mm-hmm. You have Robert Forrester.
Mm-hmm. Robert Forrester, which he played a douche. Yeah. Every doctor in this movie was an asshole.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So many assholes.
So weird.
Yeah. And this one is where he kind of felt like more like a crusader. Like he was killing all these dicks, douchebags more. Robert Forrester just showed up
to be killed.
To be an asshole and get killed.
Yeah. There was a lot of characters that just show up and get killed and show up and get killed. And it makes sense that there was a lot of problems behind the set. There was like just literally like, we just need a filler, so let's just introduce another character and kill him,
and then we
keep going.
Mm-hmm.
I like how that smarmy surgeon, you know, where that Dobby's like, well, why don't you help these people? You know, because he's pissed at him. He goes, well, I'll help these people sitting in the waiting room. And then, well, he's a surgeon. He's not going
to.
But he was like, it was what was kind of crazy about him is he just kept walking out of surgery just covered in blood. Just covered
so much blood.
What are you doing in there?
Yeah. And there's that one point, like, does he just take off his gloves, but he's still got his bloody smock on? And he starts eating.
Is this the one where is that the surgeon who also looked like he was maybe 22?
Yeah. Like, he looked like a young guy.
And surgeon MD.
And you got
he wasn't as likable as Doogie though.
No. Oh my goodness.
And Robert Davi, one of our favorite roles of him, even though it's a small role, is Big Johnson in Die Hard. And there's a scene where Little Johnson shows up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my
Grand
god.
Bush.
Awesome.
But yeah, I was like, I couldn't believe when he showed up. I was like, oh my god, they put them to the
again. Well, and so Paul Gleason was in there too, wasn't he? Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
Paul
Gleason.
The whole Die Hard, everyone but Bruce Willis showed up in Maniac Cop 3.
Yeah.
God.
Paul Gleason played the moronic police captain in the Die Hard.
Yeah, the Dwayne T. Robinson.
Head of the LAPD.
Yeah. He's also the principal in Breakfast Club.
Right.
He always plays just like a douchebag.
He was in the scene with Robert Forrester.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
That was good. That was great. I was like, ooh, this is going to be great. Oh, it's over.
Yeah. I love Robert Forrester. And then it just, and I'm not used to seeing him play a jerk.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
He just doesn't do that. He did well.
There was a lot of really great, like, cameos and character actors again in this film, but it's just like, it just fell apart because of the, clearly chaos behind the scenes and
too many cooks in the kitchen kind of
but I'd say it's still fun, it's still worth a watch. I mean, I think it's the weakest of the three, but and that ending stunt is worth watching if you want to skim through.
I was gonna say you can find that stunt on YouTube or like the scenes, the good scenes on YouTube.
They're also both, all three of these movies are available streaming right now on Amazon and Shudder, so if people have that, they can check them out, or at least they are at the point where we're recording this.
Seriously, make yourself a maniac party, maniac cop party one weekend. Get some friends together, order a pizza. It's fun.
Every time a new movie starts, order a pizza.
And I'll say, like,
every time. Just get really like heavy, buddy.
The Blu-rays, there's the Synapse put up the first film, and then the other two, parts two and three, are put out by Blue Underground, but all three of them have behind-the-scenes docs that are about a half hour each, and they have extra interviews with Tom Atkins and Robert Zadar, and there's a lot of really pretty interesting features they kind of go into that. If you're interested in that kind of stuff, it's really fascinating.
Is there commentary tracks?
I believe so. Yeah. So yeah, nice. They did a pretty good job of stacking all those discs. It's weird to me that Lustig, who owns Blue Underground, he put out three, which is a film that he is very clearly hates to this day, but put it out and put a bunch of effort into putting out a lot of features on it. But put out two and three, but he doesn't have the rights to one. Synapse has the rights to one.
Yeah, I don't know how that worked out. That's have you ever seen his movie, early movie Vigilante?
Yes.
Vigilante.
Robert Forrester.
Yeah, Robert Forster. I really like that one too.
Yeah,
I think that's a great movie.
We watched it a long time ago on VHS, but it's kind of a vigilante movie. It's a bunch of people in New York that are like there's a lot of crime, and they like band together to try and fight back against this like gang that's like been kidnapped. So, pretty good though. Like, and it has a great Jay Chataway score, like a lot of Bill Lustig's films. And the score for Vigilante is great, but it's never been released that I can find. Like, I hope that somebody can put that one out, because that, like, especially the title track. Well, real quick, I was going to say there is a remake in the works of Maniac Cop right now. It's a feature film for HBO, but it's not a series. It's a film. Lustig is a producer on it, and so is Nicholas Winding Refn. But the script is being written by Ed Brubaker, the comic book writer that we were talking about before.
Yeah, we're just talking about him.
What? Yeah. How? Ugh. So my least favorite working director and my most favorite of all time writer.
Yeah, but one of them. Well, they did
he's
work
directing it. Is Ren directing it?
I don't think so. I think he's producing it. Yeah, I don't think he's directing it. I mean,
is he just using his money? Like,
yeah,
that'd be
I think
fine.
So. Yeah,
that's fine. Don't put your long, needless scenes in my.
I like Drive. Yeah. I thought Drive was a good movie.
I think Bronson's great too.
Bronson's very good.
Bronson's good too.
But no, I mean, they worked together on the Never Too Old to Die Young, that series.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Brubaker did lend some story writing stuff to that.
Yeah, we never got past the first episode. Yeah, it's so couldn't. Pretentious.
Yeah.
It's the most pretentious thing I've ever seen. I was like, why?
Yeah. Is there any other killer cop movies that you want to just briefly touch on?
Yeah, I watched Psycho Cop Returns, who was directed by Adam Rifkin,
mm-hmm.
who I love. I did not love Psycho Cop Returns.
Yeah.
It was pretty silly.
Well, and I think Adam Rifkin used his alias for it, right? Rick Coogan.
Yeah. But yeah, and I watched the original Psycho Cop on YouTube, and that was even worse.
It's basically like the cop is like a Satanist?
Yeah, the idea is he talks a lot, and he's not supernatural, and he's not anything special. He just shows up and makes bad cop puns and draws pentagrams on everything.
Yeah. So he's like a real cop.
They all make puns.
I imagine they do. And they probably all worship the devil. I don't know.
Yeah. Psycho Cop Returns, I watched when that Vinegar Syndrome disc came out. And it was just like, I don't know. It's very lowbrow. It kind of reminds me of like a trauma film in some regards, of like the kind of like dumb, kind of really dumb, dumb dialogue that's very like eye-rolly, punny.
Right.
And just like, it's just, I don't know.
It's just dumb. I mean, it's a great disc. Vinegar Syndrome did a lot of work for a really crummy movie.
Which is not the first time they've done that.
No. But God bless them for it.
Yeah, exactly.
I love them.
Yeah.
Oh, my favorite killer cop movie is RoboCop. Because Ed 209 is a freaking killer.
That's true. And stop motion animated by Phil Tippett.
And it sounds like a lion.
Lion roaring.
Elephant. Yeah.
I think you better do what he says, Mr. Kenny.
You now have 15 seconds to comply. You are in direct violation of Penal Code 113, Section 9. You now have 5 seconds to comply.
Well, yeah, let's get into the rap, the Maniac Cop 2 rap. But just real quick, at this point in time, in like the late 80s, early 90s, this was like a really common thing for some reason. Like, it was really, really common for film productions to write a closing like credits rap song that describes the movie, or like is like trying to describe the movie. I guess
I just got like a music history question real quick. When does rap come in? Like, what's when does Blondie like have her rap thing happen? Like, what year is that?
That would have been 79, I think. Seven.
Yeah. So, like, it can't. Like, I'm like, well, because they were just trying to cash in on something. But like, rap had been around for
no,
a
it had
while.
Definitely been around
like,
for a long
what?
Time.
Like, why all of a sudden are you like
more and more mainstream at that point? You know, we had New Edition and these R&B / rap bands going on.
Yeah, but
and
then
the Fat Boys.
Yeah, the Fat Boys definitely did.
But then there's also like that's when NWA was like, or again, timelines are hard for me. Like,
no, I mean,
NWA was like late 80s, so.
But yeah, I think it was like, I mean, it was like you had like the Fresh Prince and DJ Jazzy Jeff, and they did like Nightmare on My Street.
I guess.
And you had like we were saying, the Fat Boys, and they even did like some, you know, multiple Fat Boy movies.
The suburb
at least.
Kids so,
like,
were getting into it, basically, is what we're saying.
Yeah, but all the suburb kids, like in that era, like the suburb kids that I knew, they were all listening to gangster rap.
Well, but yeah, then but, you also had like MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice and things like that that were like becoming huge.
I heard that stuff on the radio. I
what I'm hearing, Colette, is that you want more gangster rap in your movies.
What I'm saying is that I never understood why this happened. Like, because in my mind, I was like, oh, because they're just trying to cash in on it when I was younger. But like, then as I start understanding more how things fit in and whatever, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, I can't think of a successful
Colette,
one.
I think young Colette was onto something, because I think it was just I mean, especially Adam's Family had
the Adam's Family rap with like MC Hammer.
But like, that wasn't successful.
Did Nothing But Trouble have a rap song?
Did that
like,
song
Digital Underground
well?
Or something?
The Adam's Family rap was huge.
Yeah, it was huge.
What year
huge.
Is that? That's in the 90s though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 92.
So that can't be why they started doing it.
No, but it happened before that. I'm saying like Nightmare on Elm Street 4 had the closing rap by the Fat Boys.
Was that popular?
I don't
think I ever heard that.
It was. I mean, it was popular enough. Just popular to say Dream Warriors was before by Duncan.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. And then you had, I mean, like the Monster Squad had their closing rap song. But
Monster Squad wasn't even a big movie.
No, and it wasn't. I mean, the song wasn't big, but because the movie wasn't big, Monster Squad.
But that's what I'm saying. Is like, this isn't just like a little blip. Like, no. Every fucking body did it. Like commercials, TV shows, like
I would guess that everybody. I mean, because at this point, you have films that are big, but then they're monster hits because of things like Saturday Night Fever with a soundtrack, or the Flashdance, or Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters theme was like a massive hit. That then Ghostbusters 2 had a closing credits rap song. Yep. I think the selling of a song was added marketing and added boost.
I get that.
So I think
like when it didn't work, video. Why didn't they stop?
Because
it worked. It worked a lot. It worked.
Ninja Rap, if the dice, the
but again, that's
ice
later.
In TMNT. Well, I think that they were trying things, and you know, some of them hit, some of them don't. Like everybody, you know, every film at that point was starting to try to put a pop song in it, and not every pop song hit.
And rap kind of lends itself to that, because you can tell a story in rap more than you can like in traditional rock music.
I mean, I think we're at this point, we're just speculating, but I mean, that's the best guess I got. I mean, I don't know. It's some of it's very awkward now. I mean, most of it is.
I mean, it was awkward then. Like I get really uncomfortable when things are like the wrong kind of uncomfortable. And like those raps inserted into things made me
just want to throw up. Oh, it was awesome.
No, it was just like, I am so embarrassed for you. Like, why is this happening?
There's also the Tales from the Crypt Crip Jam, which is also, that's a doozy. And even later, the end credits to Deep Blue Sea.
No.
Deepest, bluest, my hat is like a shark's fin.
Nice.
It is if you like put it on your head wrong. Sure.
I think Nothing But Trouble, that LL horrible cool movie with Dan Aykroyd, had Digital Underground.
You're right. It did. It did have Digital Underground.
What?
Yeah.
What did?
No, Nothing But Trouble. Yeah, the Dan Aykroyd movie. Because they show up, right? Because like they're in the movie where they're like their tour bus like gets stranded at the house, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, good for them, but like still, like still, like what? Like I mean, I get like, you know, I get one, like I can see it from like, you know, the musician's point of view of like, let's get a paycheck, or let's get into a different audience, or like let's whatever. Well, but like
are you telling me you don't like the blues jam in Adventures in Babysitting when they all
I didn't see that movie until I was older, I don't think. So probably no.
All right, which ones are we talking about?
Well, I'll say let's listen to a little bit of the Maniac Cop 2 wrap here, since we've been going on and teasing it so much. This is a little bit of that.
Sound, it means that the maniac cop's around. Once upon a time, he was a super cop, but the bad guys threatened to make him stop. They put him in prison where they tried to kill him, but he broke out, now he's the villain. Bullets won't hurt him, I know it sounds like jive, but we're not sure if he's dead or alive.
Set him on fire, I shoot him with a Uzi, but he'll show up in your jacuzzi. You can run him over, you can feed him poison, push him out a window and it only annoys him. You better believe me if they think I'm lying. When he show up,
yeah,
people start dying. He's out for vengeance and he can't be stopped. That's why they call him the Maniac Cop.
You have the right to remain silent.
Anyway.
Okay, I take something back. I take it back a little bit because I feel like, while we were listening to it, I was like, oh, right, this was like pitched as a completely different movie. I wonder if Larry Cohen had already reached out to them.
No, because no. So this was for part two. The part three was the,
right.
Was the
what
one.
The fuck?
So the story behind the scenes of this one was that Lustig had pitched to Jay Chataway, who was doing the score, that they wanted an end credits pop song. And Jay Chataway then took that as, I guess he was going to do a rap song. And then Bill said that Lustig, that they had like, he's like came out and there was like, just like a bunch of like rappers like in the waiting room that they were like, that Jay Chataway was like trying out from like Harlem or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like he had put done basically like a call for rappers, and they like, so Jay Chataway co-wrote the song with the two rappers or whatever.
But that's not his story of that was so different. The songwriter's story of it. Cause he was just like, yeah, my keyboard player, like him and his keyboard player, like wrote it. Found a guy and wrote it, like,
yeah, it's very strange. But like,
the
how
behind the scenes on that one, the interviews on that one were interesting,
yeah,
but
it's just it's funny that they rhyme Uzi with jacuzzi, and that's my favorite part. But it's also it's funny because Bill Lustig was what's his, the maniac, Bill, what's the, who's the lead in Maniac? Joe Spinell.
Joe Spinell.
So Joe Spinell wanted a pop song in the end credit of Maniac, which is a film that would never fit tonally with a pop song being at the end credits. Mm-hmm. And Bill Lustig fought against him to do that, even though he really, really wanted it. And then flash forward a few years later, the song on Flashdance, Maniac, it was written about the film Maniac. Those people who wrote that song didn't write it for Flashdance. They wrote it about the film Maniac, and they changed the lyrics for Flashdance. When you listen to that song, it makes a lot more sense that it doesn't, because it doesn't fit in Flashdance at all.
No. Except that she's a Stilltown worker.
Right, yeah, that's the they changed a few of the lyrics to fit. Yeah. But that song was written about Maniac, which that's hilarious. Awesome.
Yeah, she's a maniac on the floor. That's not describing a dancer.
So we should, we should definitely wrap this up.
Yep.
We should wrap it up.
Yeah, we'll have to just drop in some clips here, but we should definitely drop in a clip of the Crypt Jam, the Tales from the Crypt song.
Welcome, kiddies. Would you like to dance to death? All you have to do is come to the Crypt Keeper's party. A monster bash, if you will. Come on down!
Oh boy. And then we should I guess Nightmare on Elm Street 4 is kind of a big one as well.
Even in part 3, the Dream Warriors failed, and Mr. Big Time Freddy Krueger prevailed. It was just about time, I know you'll never forget what he did to the girl with the TV set. But you can't stop Freddy, cause he's cool as ice. Come right back at ya to slash and slay. Like a Jitsu blade, like a Blender Hill Blitz, Freddy Krueger's putting on the ring.
Thank you.
I'm gonna thrill you too.
Fat Boys.
The Addams Family rap, or that what I can't remember what it's, what, if that's the name of it, but it's the Addams Family MC Hammer song. We actually have the full music video for that on 35mm mm-hmm. that we picked up while we were doing the Trailer Trash Show. Running through that shit, so.
Some strange neighbors.
They do what they wanna do, say what they wanna say, live how they wanna live, play how they wanna play, dance how they wanna dance, kick and they stop a friend.
That one's not bad, but that's his whole shtick, is being yeah. that level of cheesy.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Well, usually they find those acts though, like Vanilla Ice, obviously, Fat Boys. They're an act, you know, and Bobby Brown, you know.
Vanilla Ice was really trying to be serious, I think.
With Ninja Rap?
Not with Ninja Rap, but I think his career, he was like trying to be taken seriously. Yeah. Like, yeah. I think he was not doing that for fun. And then he was like, oh, you'll give me money to write this? Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's in the movie too.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of strange choices being made at this point, but lots of wonderful, wonderful, terrible rap songs.
Songs to make you cry.
Yeah.
I think we're. I think we've definitely tackled about as much maniac cop action as we can. Unless you have anything else you want to add, Colette.
Cops are bad. Abolish the police.
Yeah.
In reality.
Yeah.
We can still have them in movies. That would be fine.
All right. Well, on that note,
check us out on our Facebook page, Video Killers Facebook page, the Tape Freaks Facebook page, and the tapefreaks.blogspot. And then, yeah, check back next week for some more nerdy film tomfoolery.
Bye.
Come back now. You hear?
Y'all come back now. You hear? Next week on Video Killers.
I'm the one that killed Monday and whooped Tuesday and put Wednesday in the hospital. Called up Thursday to tell Friday not to bury Sarah Jones Sunday. I've got an all-girl army that knows what to do. They're fox as hell and practice kung fu. Dolomite. From the first to the last, I give them the blast so fast that their life is...